Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
the untruth hurts. Former Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole tells us foreign interference could have cost his party up to 9 seats in the last election. And he says government officials should have done more to warn Canadians about it.
The wrong side of the beds. Ontario said no one was charged for staying in a hospital after refusing a long-term care bed. But our guest says that when her father-in-law did that, he was charged more than $5,000.
Losing a battle hoping to win the war, a Ugandan activist is defiant and emotional as she tells us about the Constitutional Court's decision to uphold one of the world's harshest anti-gay laws.
Putting the con in connoisseur, a former police detective gives us his review of newly exposed Google reviews that seem to reveal where an Irish drug kingpin has been hiding, not to mention what he thinks of the acai bowl at a Dubai restaurant.
A split-second opinion. After a controversial end to a basketball game, the teams are told they won't have to go to all the trouble of replaying the whole thing. Just those last 0.3 seconds.
And he really put his big foot in it. After his state legislature passes a bill banning chemtrails, which don't exist, one Tennessee lawmaker puts pen to paper and tongue in cheek and adds an amendment to protect mythical ape creatures. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that ain't seen nothing yeti. When it comes to foreign interference, it's not just Canadian voters who are losing out, but the Conservative Party of Canada as well. That was the message Aaron O'Toole wanted to get across today. The former MP and federal Conservative leader testified before the public inquiry on foreign interference. He said there were discrepancies in several ridings in the 2021 election where the party's modeling did not match up with election results, discrepancies that lost the Conservatives seats.
5 to 9 seats that I think were possibly changed as a result of foreign interference. Narrower margin seats where we had large numbers of people not voting and suspicions about voter suppression in those specific seats. Certainly nowhere near enough to change the results of the election, but for people in those seats, if they were undergoing intimidation or suppression measures, their democratic rights were being trampled on by foreign actors.
Former Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole testifying today at the public inquiry on foreign interference. We reached Aaron O'Toole in Ottawa.
Aaron O'Toole, when you talk about the impact of those seat losses on your party and on you personally, how can you be sure it was foreign interference and not something else? The Conservative position on vaccine mandates, for example.
Well, I said it was one of several factors that that made it much more difficult to stay on after an election loss. The vaccine issue was really the main issue on why we ended up losing in the final week of the election. But as we saw reports on the extent of foreign interference, we knew that the reports we were hearing of intimidation and pressure on Chinese Canadians, it led me to sort of make sure that we're looking at this in a serious way so that future elections, people have their democratic rights preserved.
And give our listeners a sense, if you could, of what the campaign of misinformation that you've testified about looked like from where you were standing.
Well, by early in the campaign, we saw efforts on WeChat, which is a platform that is controlled by China that up to 600,000 Canadians use to get their information. We saw very, very misleading campaigns on there against me, directed towards several of our candidates. And the volume was so intense and regular that it was really hard for us to counter that. And certainly there was a sense of pressure that some people almost didn't want to vote because they didn't want it to complicate things for their family in China or their business.
And we know that the Security and Intelligence Threats Election Task Force site knew about these efforts. When did they share them with you?
Well, they never really did share with us direct examples of influence or things they were tracking. We were sharing almost in a one-way communication, things we were hearing from the field, from candidates, from organizers, but there wasn't a two-way flow of information. And I think that was a failure on their part to inform us because we weren't ready for the level of misinformation. And I never spoke about it publicly because we lost the election. It would only have been a handful of seats. But I think those votes, every voter in our democracy is important.
But why not voice those concerns earlier if you're so concerned?
Because trust in our democracy and in our institutions was a lot more important than my disappointment in losing. I was very worried that if we raised these concerns on election night or afterwards, people would suggest that I was doing things in a similar fashion to Mr. Trump and not respecting the result.
If you were told in detail what was happening, what you know more about now, what should have been done differently in that moment?
The protocols that the Trudeau government put in place didn't feel that a warning was warranted. I do think we should have warned Canadians, particularly in the lower mainland of British Columbia and the greater Toronto area, that there were misinformation campaigns underway, and to be very, very skeptical of things they read on social media platforms. Social media can be a place for misinformation of all types, but now we're seeing WeChat, TikTok. These are entities that are controlled by China, and I think we have to have a lot more transparency and buyer beware in terms of the people that rely on them for news.
When we talk about platforms like WeChat, which you've mentioned a couple of times now, and the ability of security agencies to moderate them, do you think they can be reined in, or do you support a ban?
Well, I've expressed real concern about TikTok over the last 2 years, really, because very, very easily algorithms can be manipulated to push a message, and they also have the ability to track all the users, where they live, what they're interested in, and to potentially change their perception of issues. What I think we need is to make sure that our intelligence agencies can truly see what the algorithm is pushing to a voter in the lower mainland versus someone who's just monitoring the platform. So at the bare minimum, I think we should be alerting people to the fact that some of them can be used for misinformation. And I hope in a nonpartisan way, the panel will and the inquiry will listen to everyone and provide some recommendations just to make sure that people's rights are protected in the next election.
Yeah, as you likely know, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was asked about this today and said, quote, "I can understand where someone who lost an election is trying to look for reasons other than themselves why they may have lost an election," end quote. So you mentioned your concerns about raising this in the aftermath of your loss. When you hear that today from the Prime Minister, what do you say?
Well, I was disappointed by that comment. The very fact that I didn't raise it while I was Conservative leader at all publicly was because I think our institutions deserve more respect than comments like that. I lost the election. I congratulated Mr. Trudeau that evening. The interference would not have changed the overall result. I've always been very clear on that. But if even one person is intimidated to a point that they decide not to exercise their rights as a Canadian, that should concern Mr. Trudeau as much as it does me. And that's why this inquiry that he fought and tried to have a special rapporteur, he's avoided some of these real decisions that I think a mature and professional government needs to do.
He and members of his cabinet, government officials as well, are slated to appear. What you've heard so far at this inquiry, it's something your party pushed for, certainly. How would you assess the amount of information and answers you've been getting so far?
Well, at least the Hogue inquiry is having more information sharing from the government. In fact, I saw documents just in the last 24 hours that were created by the rapid response mechanism during the campaign that we should have been shown at the time. They were monitoring misinformation efforts by China, by Russia. The fact that they knew some of this was happening and then suggested to us not to worry about any of it. That's what was broken the last time around, and that's why I've been pushing for the inquiry so that all parties and all Canadians can have a transparent look at how can we put some measures in place to protect voters, to prevent misinformation, and to educate Canadians. I think it should be a nonpartisan exercise, and I hope the Prime Minister can walk the talk and really adopt some of these measures before the next election.
Aaron O'Toole, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Aaron O'Toole is a former federal Conservative leader and MP. He's in Ottawa. It's been described as one of the world's harshest anti-gay laws. And today, despite pressure from activists to strike it down, Uganda's constitutional court largely upheld it. It was signed by the country's president last May, and it allows for the death penalty for so-called aggravated homosexuality. We spoke with Ugandan 2SLGBTQ plus activist Kasia Jacqueline Nabagesera last year as the law made its way through Parliament. We reached her today in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Kasia, as this decision was approaching, did it fill you with dread, or did you still have hope that they might rule in your favor and the other activists' favor to overturn this law?
Now, to be honest, none of us was really surprised because of the actions of our government over the months leading up to today's decision. Because the executive, the judiciary, have always been intertwined and always been influenced. So really, as you can see, even on our social medias and all this, no one is crying for what, because we knew.
Some of the provisions were struck down, things that, for example, you know, leasing to a gay person or the provision about reporting relationships. What do you think about But those steps that they struck down, those provisions?
No, it's very funny and ironic, because in the very beginning, when the bill was first proposed, we said, how can you stop people from renting people's houses?
So do you think this striking down those provisions was just for show, to suggest something?
It's just for show, to show Ugandans that. But let me tell you, for them to say that this law has to go on, it has given them impunity. Now, we've been struggling with people being beaten, biased every day. Now it has given them impunity because they're protected by the law.
When you were on our program last time, when we talked about this, you talked about the abuse, the violence, the harassment that you faced. Yes. How are people that you're talking to, you know, preparing to keep themselves safe?
I want to tell you, I have not opened, and I've done that intentionally, because most of us petitioners are out of the country right now. I'm here with the director of the leading lesbian organization, and then my colleague Frag is in DC, because we've just come from CSW in New York. So most of us are out of the country. And people are writing me, and I'm intentionally refusing to open their messages because I don't have answers. Mm. And that's the sad reality that we are going through.
And just imagining those letters coming and you being unable to open them, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, because I'm scared of opening them. I don't know what to expect. And that's why I keep my phone on silence, because I don't know what I'm going. Then slowly by slowly, I open them. And it's always traumatizing. So you can imagine.
Yeah.
Let me tell you one thing. Today, the whole community, even as I speak, every Wednesday we have these catch-up meetings for the community. Everyone is quiet today, not because they don't have what to say, because they're like, we all knew what was going to happen, but it's because it's now giving them the leverage. Now, Ugandans, you can continue to kill, to beat, to rape, to do this, people who simply love different from you.
There is what the government does, what courts say, and then there is what the public thinks.
Our government and the court are one, one in the same.
How would you describe the general public's feeling? Is it out of line with what the government is doing there?
No, they've been given a leeway to get any person perceived to be different from them, LGBTQ, even the stereotyping of how homosexuals look like, and all this, now it's going to go high. They're going to start beating and killing children, youths, anyone who is different from the patriarchal system of a man is supposed to look like this, a woman is supposed to look like this. They are going to go, because this is what the government and the religious leaders, the propagandists, have decided to do. And this has been cemented by the court ruling today. And this is what I'm saying, that I'm pissed.
Oh, Kasha, I'm so sorry.
Don't be sorry, you didn't do it. But talk to your government that allows these people to come to my country. Where are the checks and balances who allow these people who come to my country? Because if it wasn't for these extremists, the fundamentalist evangelicals, to come to my country, we did not have this. My people are studying today because it's overwhelming. I'm sorry.
Please don't apologize. I appreciate you sharing all of this with us. This is a difficult day for a lot of people.
I'm sorry. Bye-bye.
Okay. Kasha, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
That was Ugandan activist and petitioner Kasha Jacqueline Nabagesera in Worcester, Massachusetts. Narco kingpin Christopher Kinahan is one of the world's most wanted men. In addition to drug crimes, the Kinahan cartel is thought to be behind arms trafficking, money laundering, and multiple murders. Mr. Kinahan started his criminal career in Ireland and went international. He's wanted both in Europe and the U.S., so not surprisingly, he's been on the run for years, which makes these remarks all the more puzzling. Quote, "The restaurant is chic and plush. The service was good, but not outstanding." Unquote. And, "I had the acai bowl, followed by eggs with almond bread and green salad. My meal was well presented and tasty. I give this establishment 5 stars. Unquote. Those are Google reviews of restaurants in Istanbul and Dubai, respectively, written under an alias known to be used by Christopher Kinahan. Investigative journalists at Bellingcat found those, along with various other reviews of hotels and hot spots in Spain, Hungary, Hong Kong, Zimbabwe, and more, all tied to an online profile believed to be his. Michael O'Sullivan is a former detective with the Irish Police Service who has a long history with Mr. Kinahan. We reached him in Lisbon.
Michael, what do you think these online reviews are all about?
Well, I to put it in perspective, I don't believe they're coming from him. I think they're about creating a smokescreen or a false trail, knowing the individual. If I saw a post that he was in Spain, I would know for certain he wasn't in Spain, because that's what he would do. He's a very cunning guy who tries to keep a low profile, and he's currently under big pressure, both from the Irish judicial authorities, from the U.S. Treasury, from various other law enforcement agencies in Europe. So I'd go as far as to say he's in the last chance saloon. He's in Dubai, and he is very conscious that lots of people, including some rival gangsters want to know where he is.
Another theory, something that certainly came to our mind, as well as investigative reporter Nicola Tallant's mind, she's in Ireland and covering the story, as you likely know. We spoke with her, and she suggested that this might be some sort of a communication tool, coded messages of some kind. You know, we've talked about this on the show in terms of the Italian mob putting handwritten notes in the legs of chairs. Is this something similar to that, just a more high-tech version?
No, it's not. It definitely isn't at play. It is, look, he is well versed at leaving encrypted communications with a variety of people and carrying a variety of phones and having a variety of methods of communicating and putting some post up concerning some restaurant and that somebody would decipher some secret code from it. No, it doesn't work like that. They wouldn't put it on view for the world and his mother, as we would say, to look at it. No.
We've mentioned that you have a long history with Christopher Christie Kinahan. You first encountered him back in 1986. It was a big moment kind of early on in your career, but also his. What happened?
Yeah, by way of background, he was a fraudster, bounced checks and stuff like that, had no real drug involvement. And saw the heroin scene mushrooming in Dublin. Heroin had come to Dublin in the very early 80s, 81, 82. And he saw the profits to be made, so he decided he would set up a heroin network with him at the top, and he would firewall it with various minions around him, so he would be the silent managing director, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he rented a luxury apartment far away from all of the gritty grime and drug dealing in back streets of Dublin, and I was part of a team, an undercover team, and we targeted him, and I arrested him in 1987, and he was obviously quite surprised to be caught with what could be described as a motherload of heroin. He had a lot of heroin in the apartment. Now, he himself had no idea of the mechanics of supplying heroin. He left that to others who were in the trade. But he was quite surprised to have got caught, and he served several years. And that sort of, he used the time very constructively, and he decided that he would learn from his mistakes.
Broaden the operation?
Broaden the operations and figure out what was the best line of criminality to go into. And his career took off from that. And he moved then to the Netherlands, and he came back, and he was for his father's funeral, and he was arrested and served some more years, and then he went to the Netherlands, where he established a network. Mm-hmm. And the pressure came on there, and he moved to the south of Spain.
Just to go back to his father's funeral, that again, it was you who arrested them. Yeah. So you've had a few encounters. Is that the one that stands out most in your mind?
Well, I suppose, yeah, look, they both stand out. I arrested him at his father's funeral because he came back and interviewed him. And I'm probably the one who knows him best. I've known him. Our careers have run parallel, really, I suppose. He's on one side of the law and I'm on the other. And we've been both around a long time.
What did he say, if anything, to you in those moments?
Well, actually, with a funny incident, I interviewed him and he wouldn't talk for a while. And then he looked at me and he said, "You think you're so smart." He said, I followed you about a year ago. So I said, "I know you did." And I told him the number of the car that he followed me in, because I'd seen him. And that was the last conversation I had with him. So he's gone from that to the multi-million dollar business of crime and is now based in Dubai.
How do you feel about the fact he has not been caught now, you know, that he's risen to this? Is this something that bothers you or eats away at you?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. There's a saying, he has to be lucky all the time. Law enforcement have to be lucky once, and it's a long road. And he's got to keep looking over his shoulder and wondering when that knock will come on the door. And it eventually will. It happens to the best of them.
What ultimately is it going to take beyond, you know, running out of luck for him to be caught?
It will take the combined cooperation and collaboration of various law enforcement agencies, and he has left Europe because of the cooperation of law enforcement agencies, went from one country to the other, and now he is reluctant and won't come back to Europe. and he's running out of places to hide. And what will it take? It will take whatever country he's in, perhaps applying pressure or looking to extradite him. It is only a matter of time before something happens.
Michael, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Michael O'Sullivan is a former detective with the Irish Police Service. We reached him in Lisbon. Any basketball team knows it's important to get pumped up. That's why you choose a rousing anthem to blast from the sidelines. Something like this classic.
The jam, pump it up while your feet are stumping, and the jam is pumping. Look ahead, the crowd is jumping. Pump it up.
Pump up the jam with its timeless message of jumping, stomping, getting your booty on a floor, and making the singer's day, whoever she is. A song to unite a team during a crucial game. Unless you play basketball for the Irish men's basketball teams Limerick Sport Eagles or the Portlaoise Panthers, and you play the makeup game mandated by your sport's governing body. In that case, it would be a little tougher for your pump-up song to pump you up because you wouldn't even get to hear the whole thing. I mean, game starts, game's over. Hit the showers, guys. On March 23rd, the Eagles and the Panthers played a playoff game that was tied right to the end when the Eagles were awarded two free throws. They sank both and they won 80-78. But the Panthers appealed, arguing that the winning free throws had been awarded after the buzzer. Now, at first, officials ruled that the teams would replay the entire game, straightforward. But then they changed their minds and they issued another, more bizarre ruling. The teams would return to Portlaoise and replay just the last 0.3 seconds. Which, again, is this long. I'll play that again in case you coughed. Well, today the Portlaoise Panthers announced that they would not be taking part in this tiny charade. They forfeited the game and wished the Limerick Sport Eagles luck in the rest of the playoffs. And the truth is, no one was pumped for a game that short. And if Irish basketball officials thought everyone would show up to watch a game that lasted 3/10 of a second, well, not so fast.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Tamara Moyer's family got her elderly father-in-law the care he needed when his health took a turn for the worse, but it cost him more than $5,000. That's because the 93-year-old was charged for part of his stay in an Ontario hospital. He was billed $400 a day for refusing the first long-term care bed offered to him. The fee is the result of a controversial Ontario law passed 2 years ago called the More Beds, Better Care Act. Provincial leaders have repeatedly said that no one had been billed under that law, but since Ms. Moyer came forward to CBC News with her family story, Ontario has confirmed that 7 people have been invoiced for hospital stays. We reached Tamara Moyer in Chatham, Ontario.
Tamara, when your father-in-law first went into hospital last year, I mean, was in the list of things that were on your mind, was a bill for more than $5,000 on that list?
Oh, nowhere. Nowhere near that list. No, we were just trying to get him healthy and get him back to where he was at a residence, assisted living residence, but that didn't work out. But no, nowhere near.
You were offered a home as you were trying to get him in, as you said, into long-term care. Why did you and he refuse the first home that was offered?
We refused it because it it wasn't one of his first choices, or wasn't on his list of choices at all. And it was further away from the siblings who are quite frequent visiting him. And the one he did choose, we knew more about it. So that's basically why we stuck with our first choice.
And you did get into the preferred home that he wanted a little less than 2 weeks later after that refusal. I should ask, how is your father-in-law doing now?
Oh, he's doing very well. Yes, he's settled right in pretty much from day one. He's been doing really well and good reports and just fabulous. We're really pleased with his care.
So good news on that front, but then you get a bill. when it arrived, what did you think?
Well, we'd heard that there was no bills ever issued, no invoices ever sent. I don't know. I guess it was totally unexpected when it did come, but it's not that we didn't know about it, mm-hmm. that it might come. It's just the way everything happened so quickly, too. Like, when we refused or declined the offer, the bet offer, the first one, we had an inkling that he was going to get into where, you know, he wanted to go. Mm-hmm. Only they were experiencing COVID right then, so there was a lockdown and nothing could happen. So we just thought we'd try and wait it out.
Did you ever consider not paying the bill?
We did consider that a bit, and we spoke to a couple different people. We got nowhere with them, so yeah, so that's when we decided might as well just pay it and get it over with.
The reason the government says it wanted to bring in this law was to free up beds for those who need hospital care. So if it means going to a long-term care facility that's available but not their first choice, you know, the need for beds trumps all else. What do you make of that rationale?
Oh, well, I can partly understand it on their point. I mean, if somebody's sitting around in a hospital for months or a long period of time, they probably would maybe get more attention and more care at a long-term care. So I can see it on a little bit on a case-by-case situation. But overall, I don't think the bill is very appropriate because you're quite pressured into making that decision.
What did it feel like in that moment?
It was very stressful. We, the family members, I mean, there's four siblings, and three of them were out of the country at the time, being March, and they didn't really give any sympathy or consideration for that. They wanted, you know, decisions made and made right away. And plus, his health wasn't the best, and we really didn't even think that he should be moved out of the hospital when this bed offer came up. He'd had a serious fall while he was in the hospital about a week before we did the application for long-term care. So just a lot of factors.
Have you spoken to any of the other people who've also received bills?
No, I have no idea who they are, or supposedly we're the only one in southern Ontario. Mm-hmm. And if there's only seven in the whole province, yeah, I have no idea. They won't give us any information, or I haven't heard any information on that due to the Privacy Act.
What do you make of the fact that it is seven people in the whole of the province?
I don't believe that number. I find that very hard to believe that there's only seven, and I can't believe there's only one down here in Chatham-Kent. I think there still needs to be some follow-up and a little more clarity on that part.
I know it took you a long time to get someone to pay attention to your family's situation. Our CBC News colleague in Windsor, Jennifer LaGrassa, did listen. She reported on the story today, which led to our conversation right now. Why did you want to go public with this?
Well, I tried back in April. The day I paid the fine, the day we paid it on our father's behalf, that same day an article came out with Paul Calandra saying no fines have been issued. Mm-hmm. And that started the process. I emailed MPP, MP, I emailed CBC, Ombudsman, whatever that is. I emailed Go Public. Then there was a groundbreaking ceremony in summer. It was mentioned again, no fines have been issued. It came up again just 2 weeks ago, heard the same story again, no fines have been issued, and I just thought, we've got to do something. We've got to let people know that there is fines or charges.
Ultimately, why did you want to talk about it beyond, you know, being upset that something else was being put out there. Why was it important for you to raise this? What do you hope comes as people hear your story?
Well, my whole thought is I want the public to know. And it makes people more aware of this Bill 7. If you're not directly involved with it, some people have no idea what it's all about. So just public awareness, I guess.
Do you want a refund?
Oh, I would love a refund. But that's not my goal. I'm not going to waste my time trying to get that. If they'd like to give us a refund, that'd be great. I would like to know where the money's going. You know, and these other seven supposedly invoices that have gone out, have they been paid? And where is this money going?
Tamara, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks.
That was Tamara Moyer in Chatham, Ontario. And you can find the CBC Windsor report about her family at cbc.ca/news. The people of Tennessee can breathe easier this week. New state legislation is set to ban the intentional release of chemicals into the air. Great, whether you hate weird airborne toxins or Axe body spray, which is a weird airborne toxin, I guess. Except critics say the bill has an ulterior motive. They say it is really a disguised ban on chemtrails. Chemtrails as in the chemicals the government is using airplanes to spread secretly for the purposes of sterilization, reducing lifespans, and controlling minds. Chemtrails as in a thing that is not happening and does not exist. The bill is headed to the governor's desk, but not before Democratic Representative John Ray Clemens was able to add an amendment. His amendment would provide protections for, quote, a large and hairy human-like creature that inhabits forests in North America, unquote. John Ray Clemens is the chairman of the Tennessee House Democratic Caucus. We reached him in Nashville, Tennessee.
Representative Clemens, this bill was brought to the House floor there on April Fool's Day, which, you know, makes a lot of people wonder, is this actually real? Is it?
Well, unfortunately, it is. I had hoped that it was a joke as well and tried to treat it as such on the House floor when it passed by attaching an amendment to it that was made in jest. But unfortunately, it's very real, and it's just par for the course with some of these Republican representatives with whom I serve.
That amendment would protect Bigfoot, as we hinted at in the introduction that our listeners just heard there. You intended to withdraw it, but what happened?
Yeah, so I obviously made it a jest. It was April Fool's Day, but I wanted to highlight what a joke the legislation itself was by introducing another joke regarding Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And unfortunately, when I went to withdraw it, you know, I said it was a joke, and because I thought the bill itself was a joke, and I offered to withdraw my amendment and asked the sponsor to withdraw his bill from the floor, but they took offense to that, and they wanted to have a full-on debate about Sasquatch.
The sponsor of the bill, Representative Monty Fritz, said, quote, I would hope all of my colleagues are in favor of clean water, clean air, and clean soil in the state of Tennessee. The language, that's unquote, the language in the bill doesn't mention chemtrails in particular, but he's saying it's not about that. It's about clean water, clean air, clean soil in the state of Tennessee. What do you say?
Well, we're all in favor of clean water, clean air, and clean soil. In fact, we introduce a lot of legislation to that end that's regularly killed by my Republican colleagues, such as Representative Fritz. This bill was rooted in the conspiracy theory. Everybody knows it was. The government has debunked this conspiracy theory, the White House has even said there's no plans to establish any research program focused on solar radiation modification that they're talking about with these chemtrail bills. But it's just more nonsense down here when we should be focused on issues that really matter to Tennessee families.
Why do you think they're doing this? If it's rooted in conspiracy theories and Pennsylvania is pursuing a similar bill, as I understand it now, why?
Well, these MAGA Republicans that are running our state legislature and are part of other state legislatures around the United States, they've never met a conspiracy theory that they didn't like or want to introduce legislation to address, unfortunately. I mean, we've had multiple bills this year in Tennessee alone rooted in conspiracy theories. We had one bill earlier that was based on the belief that they're trying to hide vaccines in lettuce and tomatoes in grocery stores, which is just all total nonsense. And I tried to highlight the fact that it was nonsense with my Sasquatch amendment.
Yeah, it's one thing for people to go down rabbit holes online. But when things like this come up in a state legislature or any official space, how do you work around that, the joking aside?
Well, you try to, you know, redirect the attention and focus where it belongs. I mean, look, Tennessee families, Tennessee's working families have real issues facing them on a daily basis. We've got higher cost of living down here. We have major need to fully fund our public schools. We've got infrastructure projects that need to be carried out and funded. We have people who still need access to health care in this state and country. You know, these are all the issues on which we should be focused. Unfortunately, we, you know, continue to face a lot of nonsense up here and people, you know, wasting our time on conspiracy theories like chemtrails.
How do you get through to people who maybe aren't your constituents, or maybe there's some of your constituents who believe what they're hearing and reading as well with relation to chemtrails? How do you convince them otherwise?
Well, what I do to the people who I have the pleasure of representing here in Nashville is I just present them with the facts and information that I have and on which I'm basing, you know, my position. The fact that the government released a report on solar geoengineering, you know, the fact that the government acknowledged an idea or a hypothesis doesn't mean that they're actually going to follow through with it or that there's even any research program focused on that issue. Again, if the government was focusing on that or if it was a legitimate threat to air, water, and soil, we would certainly take that seriously at that time. But unfortunately, you know, conspiracy theories are being made priorities, and that's what I have a problem with, and my constituents understand that. This is my 10th year in elected office here in Nashville, and my constituents seem pretty pleased with my representation thus far.
Stories like this certainly grab headlines, and with good reason, and they can yield interesting conversations like the one we're having. But do you think it can also fuel, you know, beyond division, apathy in the political process? You know, when the political process becomes part of a punchline, what does that say to voters?
Well, I mean, we suffer from a lot of political apathy here in Tennessee. They've passed several bills to limit voter participation. We have one of the lowest voter turnout ratios in the entire country. And so we battle that constantly. And, you know, the root cause of that, I think there are many. But to the extent things like this result in voter apathy, it's something we obviously need to seek to avoid. And that's why we keep focusing on issues that people actually care about. I mean, Democrats here in Tennessee, at least, are the only ones up here talking about those issues. And it's our hope and sincere desire that they'll vote. Not only get out and vote, but vote for change and Democrats who are actually, you know, working and putting our head down, rolling up our sleeves to solve those pressing issues. And I think it's important, if our colleagues across the aisle on the far right or extremists want to push these conspiracy theories, they need to be called out on it. And I try to do it in as, you know, a collegial way as possible, but they need to be made to look as absurd as they truly are sometimes.
Representative Clemens, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate, I'm sorry there's actually attention on this issue, but I appreciate the discussion. It's very important to have these conversations.
State Representative John Ray Clemens is the chairman of the Tennessee House Democratic Caucus. We reached him in Nashville, Tennessee. NATO's Secretary General thinks it's time for the alliance to put a lot of its money where its mouth is. Foreign ministers are discussing a proposal by Jens Stoltenberg for a five-year, 100 billion euro fund for Ukraine. It would be the first time NATO itself provided direct lethal aid to Ukraine, which is bound to anger Russia. The idea is meant to establish sustainable funding for Ukraine's war effort that's not subject to the whims of domestic politics. Viola von Kramon has been pushing for the fund. She's a German member of the European Parliament. We reached her today in Kyiv, Ukraine.
Viola von Kramon, you're in Ukraine, as we mentioned, in Kyiv. You were also on the front lines, as I understand it. What did you hear there that convinces you that more aid is necessary right now?
Oh, first of all, it was not my first visit at the front line. And to be honest, it's becoming worse and worse. And the commanders, the soldiers I've spoken to, of course, there is a big concern that everyone gets tired of the war. While they are fighting, for us, there's no reason to become tired. And I mean, they are lacking almost everything. They are lacking air defense. They are lacking ammunition 155. They are lacking all kinds of other weapon categories, especially, of course, long-range missiles. So they need of everything to make sure to liberate their territory.
How, though, when you get back to Germany, do you think you will sell this to your constituents there? I ask because, as you well know, Ukraine has received more than 250 billion euros in terms of committed aid from all around the world. Are you worried that a point is going to come that even if voters care deeply about what is happening and wish the war would end, that they don't necessarily want to continue supporting in a financial way?
I don't think we have an alternative. This is a marathon. We are not even half through. And I think we have to convince our constituents, and that is what I do on a daily basis, that if Russia wins in Ukraine, there is no security whatsoever in Europe, in the European Union. So this war and the outcome of the war, the result of the war, will be decisive for our own security in the European Union. And people in Germany, they do understand. Our problem is more that our leadership, our chancellor, doesn't want to admit that there is no alternative.
At the NATO talks on this, there's certainly no decisions yet. There isn't agreement on this.
Absolutely. For all of us who are supporting Ukraine, we feel this is a historical mistake. This is a major mistake. If we stop the continuous support for Ukraine, and Putin might win here, and Putin might conquer the majority or entire country of Ukraine, the nation will not exist. This would mean that Russian troops would stand at the European borders, the European Union's border, Polish, Romania, probably Moldova will be taken by Russia, probably the Baltic state will be in danger, and everyone knows that. So for us, I don't see that there is an alternative. And as I said before, we need to keep going. And people here are rather frustrated about the skepticism, the increasing skepticism about the level of support.
What will it take, do you think, to get countries who aren't on board so far, Hungary certainly at the top of that list, some questions and push for more details from Spain and Italy, certainly. So there's varying degrees of acceptance of this and still questions out there from those countries. So what will it take to get them on board, do you think?
I don't think that Hungary could hide. If we had a strong commitment by Germany, by Berlin, by Paris, by Warsaw, by Washington, all of them are very much committed. It would be super difficult for some of the smaller ones, such as Hungary, Slovakia, also other ones, to hide behind them. So I think it is up to us, to our member states, to our commitments, to show that we are in charge, and that we pledge, and that we consider that we convince our constituency, and that we have the financial resources to support Ukraine. If you look at Russia, they have shifted to war economy from day one on, and they invest more than 100 billion per year. So if we speak about the proposal of NATO of 100 billion, this is good, but this is only a first step. Looking at Russia, they are producing 24/7 everything what is needed, from high technology to ordinary artillery, from tanks to air defense. And so I think we have to catch up. That is in our interest, for our security.
In addition to catching up, as you put it, and the need that you've described from what you've seen on the front lines, how much of this proposal has to do with concern about future governments in power? A change in power potentially in the United States?
No, absolutely. I think this is very obvious. I think that many countries, many member states in NATO are concerned about a potential change in office in the White House. I don't think this is a secret. And to make sure that NATO is increasingly in charge and not so much one member state, which had delivered a lot of weapons at the first or the beginning of the war, I think it is a good proposal. I think for the predictability, for the planning here in Ukraine, as we did with the Ukraine facility, it is good that it is a proposal on the table. But is this enough? I would say we will see. But financial resources is one thing. Industrial military capacity is another thing. And here we still lack the political will of all the member states, which could deliver.
The accusations from Russia against NATO continue to come as well. And the latest one, a repetition of what we've heard before, but saying that NATO has returned to a Cold War mindset. That's the messaging coming out as these talks go on about this proposal from Russia. What do you say in response to that?
Well, I mean, I'm not too much impressed. Putin could change this in a second. If he withdraw his troops from Ukraine, there is no appetite, there is no need from our side to invest into a military and defense budget. So it is not in our interest. I wish we could invest, we could spend our money in different sectors, in healthcare, in environmental, in climate change, climate protection, and so on. I mean, it is not my genuine interest to convince my constituents that our budget will increasingly will be gone into defense and military expenses. So, I mean, Putin is the reason why we have to invest into security. And so if he blames NATO, that is super hypocritical.
Viola Van Kramon, thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot for having me. Have a good evening.
You too.
Viola Van Kramon is a German member of the European Parliament. We reached her in Kyiv, Ukraine. It's a stark black and white photo of a firefighter standing on a huge rock in the middle of a scorched landscape that was taken during last year's forest fires in Quebec. And it has just won the World Press Photo Contest Prize for Best Single Image from North and Central America. It was taken for the Globe and Mail by the Quebec City photographer Charles-Frédéric Ouellette. But Mr. Ouellette doesn't just take pictures of fires. He also trained so he could work alongside the fire crews whose work he was hoping to record. We joined Mr. Ouellette on the road between Quebec City and Montreal.
Charles-Frédéric, congratulations.
Thank you. It's an honor to receive that prize. Yeah.
I know it can be, you know, there's feeling pride in the work and being recognized, but it's also a very difficult story, a difficult reality that you were covering. So how do you weigh all of those emotions alongside this win?
Well, actually, we've been working on that story for a while, like I say we, because I'm actually co-directing like a documentary with a fellow photographers, Nicolas Lévesque. And then we've been preparing for that for a while, for a couple of years now. We've been agreeing with the software to get access to the ground. We did the training as well to be deployed with the team. So we were pretty much aware of that process of natural regeneration that happened through fire.
The World Press Photo Jury calls your work a, quote, iconic composition and, quote, reminiscent of a monument. I'm looking at it now. We described it a little bit in the introduction to our conversation that our listeners just heard. If you take us back to the moment you captured that shot, you know, there are no pictures of flames. Why did you frame it in that way?
Well, yeah, they frame it that way. Actually, I did submit a full series of pictures where I was trying to talk about like the feeling of exhaustion, like through the firefighters after a long summer of firefighting and being on the ground with during long hours and everything. So that image is taken on a really quiet day, so a day of patrol. So we were walking all day, like for 5-6 hours in a row. So sometimes we have lots of time around. So this image, like, I had time to frame it.
Yeah. In that moment, What did you think, you know, when you see that? And you can see with your photographer's eye that, that it's quite striking.
Well, I think it's the sum of quite a few days on the ground, actually. So you sometimes don't see it, like you're in stank dust things. But like, you know, like those days, they repeat itself. Like you go to the ground, like you're spraying fire, you're working around, you're helping other teammates. So then when it's time to for the lookout, like to check if there's any more smoke around in the area, then those are the typical moves that you do every day. So I just taken it like on that day, as I did on many other days.
Of the series, is it your favorite? Is it the one you thought might catch everyone's attention?
In fact, I didn't know. Like, the jury has the liberty to extract an image from a series. I'm actually pretty happy they took that one. It's a huge honor. But yeah, I do like it quite a lot. Yeah.
The jury also said it stands as a powerful symbol of our losing battle against climate change and a metaphor for our collective arrogance in the face of the crisis. How does that assessment square with how you see that image in that moment?
I don't think I saw it in that moment in that way, because sometimes you're more into describing the events, because like you are surrounded by all my own activities of the wildfire around. But this one, as it got quieter, like maybe this image plays itself, like in the image sequence, to show some kind of step back, like you see more things aligning in this type of images where you see the context more than just the action.
Journalists always have to be removed a little bit from their subjects, but they also have to care. And it seems to me that you care deeply, and certainly deeply enough to train and understand what the firefighters are going through as you take images of them and of the fire. Why do you care so much?
Well, I think the stories touch us personally. Like, it's something that we can do something about as well. So for me, it's not a matter of just addressing the subject of climate change. It's about like what we can actually do on the ground. And as it happened this year, at the beginning of the year, like, it was so intense that there was no place for us to go on the ground and film and document. So what we could do was going to help the people, because we had the training. So we could actually do a little something. And then after that, I know I could just get back into my position as a photographer. You know?
So you did put your camera down and chip in?
Yes, indeed, yeah.
What did you end up doing specifically?
Well, everyone has to be able to do the job of the other. It's really a teamwork. Yeah. So we're working in small cells of three or four auxiliary wildfire fighter kind of, and then we're usually supervised by a real SUPFO team leader. So a lot of people can do those type of courses. It's really short training. I'm actually not a real firefighter. I'm really a photographer. Like,
yeah. And did they remind you of that? I know this was very serious work, but in the moments where you did have a moment of rest, did they sort of rib you and joke with you?
Well, kind of, yeah. I think people, like, there were a lot of people from different backgrounds as well, because it's a really short season. So a lot of people that are doing that type of work, they are usually working in the forest on different type of position. Usually they don't just do that.
You are going back for this year's fire season. I know you're working on a documentary, but you've told this story in this now award-winning image and the series that it was a part of. We know the forests are dry. It could be dangerous work again. What makes you want to go back beyond, I mean, you've told the story, beyond the documentary, why do you want to go back into that danger zone?
Well, I don't think it's a danger zone. It's really well coordinated, but I think there's plenty of different subjects as well to talk about these wildfire or climate change, because it's a really complex subject in itself. And I see now, like, different subjects I would like to treat as well on more human aspect as well.
There's more to illustrate.
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah.
You want to reveal what you want to take pictures of now?
maybe I'll keep that for myself for the moment. Like,
maybe that's smart. I had to ask, though. Charles Frederick, congratulations again. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That's really appreciated.
Charles Frederick Ouellette is a Quebec City documentarian and photographer. We reached him on the road between Quebec City and Montreal. It's official at last. As it happens, is the radio capital of Canada. Well, can sounds be a capital? Okay, you know what? Our offices are the radio capital of Canada. Well, they need a vacuum and they're infested with possums. Maybe the frequency, like the radio frequency, is the capital. No, that's different across the country. Look, the point is it's up to us. We've decided we're the capital, and why shouldn't we? Our nation's actual capital is apparently all four self-declared capitals. In a motion passed today, it ruled, quote, "Whereas Ottawa's shawarma is unquestionably the best in Canada, a civic institution and the great uniter, bringing together Ottawa residents from all backgrounds, be it resolved that Ottawa City Council officially recognize and bestow our city with the title of the Shawarma Capital of Canada," unquote. Okay, well, Windsor, Ontario begs to differ, among other cities. And, you know, shawarma is not the only wrap-based snack that has divided Canada. There was also the saga of the life-sized Donaire costume that was auctioned off by the Alberta government last year, which pitted the ultimately successful Edmonton bidders Primetime Donaire and Poutine against Halifax's King of Donaire, whose owner, Nicholas Nahas, explained his claim to the costume on our show last summer.
We brought the Donaire to Canada and introduced it here in Halifax in 1973. It's our 50th anniversary this year we're celebrating, so it'll be a nice little birthday present for Halifax and King of Donaire. And in 2015, Halifax actually voted, the city council voted to make the Donaire the official food of the city, and we are the only city in Canada with an official food.
When you say we brought it to Halifax, tell our listeners what you mean by that.
The original person who created King of Donaire is no longer here, mm-hmm. but Peter Guy Malakas, he's the person who... Greek immigrant. He moved to Halifax. He originally tried to introduce the Greek dish of the gyro here, and the Haligonians didn't take too well to it. So he had some mixed up the recipes a bit. Lamb was switched to beef for the protein. The bread was switched from a thicker sort of Greek style naan type of bread to a Lebanese pita. And the sauce was switched from a tzatziki to a sweeter garlicky sauce, which we just call as Donaire sauce. Then finally, the toppings were just really simplified to onions and tomatoes.
I do have to ask you about lettuce, because you have very strong feelings about lettuce in a Donaire.
Yeah, so somewhere along the way, when it migrated west and skipped a few provinces, it picked up lettuce along the way. And it's just, it never happened here. It didn't start with lettuce. So we don't know who introduced it or why it was introduced, but it's almost just like a fun sort of banter between the East and West. I mean, if someone comes into the store, comes in Halifax and asks for lettuce on their Donaire, you automatically know you're not from here and, you know, you're an outsider kind of thing.
You actually have a t-shirt on your website that says Anti-Lettuce Donaire Club. So if you get this costume, though, are you going to extricate the lettuce from the costume?
Absolutely.
Whoa.
And listen, we can send it out west to anyone who wants it. If they, obviously there's interest in the costume, they can have the lettuce and do what they want with it.
They can wrap themselves in the lettuce.
From our archives, King of Donaire owner Nicholas Nahas speaking with Neil in July 2023 about a lettuce-filled Donaire costume, which was ultimately purchased by Edmonton's Primetime Donaire and Poutine. In December of 1971, an epic protest rally attracted thousands of people to Ann Arbor, Michigan. John Lennon and Yoko Ono played, Stevie Wonder and Bob Seger and Archie Shepp, too. Allen Ginsberg, Jane Fonda, and Black Panther leader Bobby Seale gave speeches, and they were all there for one man, John Sinclair. He had been sentenced to 10 years in prison for handing two joints to an undercover cop, and the slogan "Free John Sinclair" became a countercultural rallying cry. Just 3 days after that rally, he was released from prison after serving just 2 years. John Sinclair, writer, activist, and counterculture hero, died yesterday at the age of 82. He was a 6'4" rabble-rouser, the son of a Flint, Michigan factory worker who pushed a radical vision of politics on the streets of Detroit. And his main vehicle for spreading that vision was the band he managed in their early days, the MC5, whose potent mix of politics and hard-driving rock and roll would serve as the template for bands like The Clash and Rage Against the Machine. MC5 co-founder Wayne Kramer once described Mr. Sinclair as one of those a lot of things to a lot of people kind of guys. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.